Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Merrick Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, joined as always by Ann Thompson, our editor at large. And Ann, for the, I guess it's the penultimate episode before the actual Oscars, we're going to take a little break from discussing whether No Man's Land is actually the obvious front runner and whether Viola Davis actually has the edge over Carey Mulligan or whatever we've been repeating ad infinitum for weeks, and focus on a totally different part of award season, which I think make the Oscars interesting all over again. And that's the short films, because you and I didn't get a chance to dig into these until recently. And what I've found, and I'll be curious to know what you have to say, because we haven't discussed this in advance, is that they're just so fundamentally different than the other movies we've been discussing that are in contention, that it really does change the terms of the award season discussion to focus on these movies. And it could not come at a better moment, I think, for either of us to have something different to talk about. But what was the experience like for you going through these three categories of doc, live action, and animation?
Well, I do this every year, and every year I do discover somewhat the same thing, which is that basically the animated feature shorts are just delightful, always. They're just wonderful, and I always marvel at the skill. And many of them are you know, there's usually a Pixar one, and there's usually a couple from, you know, a few of them are from overseas, and they're just gorgeous. And then the others, the documentary shorts, are usually very heavy. They're just usually super depressing, and it makes you, you know, it reminds you of what a lovely, luxurious life you lead, and how terrible and just humiliating life is for people around the world. And also that there are people out there who want to, you know, look after them. And then there's the live action shorts, which are often also on the serious side, but are fun to watch because they do show talent coming out, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always true. You do see that. And look, the Oscar movies in general, you don't see a lot of comedies. So in that sense, they are a microcosm of award season in general this year. And we are living in times in which there's a lot of dark stuff to explore. And so they are timely all across, I mean, almost exclusively timely in the doc section and in the live action section, the strongest ones you could argue they are, but they're also, they involve very specific kind of intimate personal situations. Whereas with the animated ones, I mean, you could argue animated films take longer to make, so they're not necessarily reflective of the era in quite the same way, but also the sensibilities of animators tend to be more abstract to a large degree, so we see a difference there. But I think
let's do the animated. So I really enjoyed there, for example, the 2D Burrow, which was just delightful and graphically delicious, and it had a point, you know. It was about creating community as opposed to staying separate, but it, you know, there's this little rabbit burrowing away from all these other communities, and then he hits water and they all have to come together. So, but I don't think, honestly, I'm just to be Oscar predictor Thompson over here, I don't think that one is the one that's going to win. You know,
well, it's just charming. It doesn't leave an impression if you look at it as part of a larger equation here. That's sort of the setback for it.
I was awestruck by Opera. Honestly,
that's my favorite too.
It's so cool. It's so cool. I couldn't take my eyes. It is a very complex algorithmic designed Describe pyramid. It, Eric. You're the critic. You try to describe this extraordinary thing.
Well, I'm sure that other people have dissected it in elaborate ways, but it seems to be a kind of a pyramid meant to represent the overall cycle of civilization as a constant, as a sort of never-ending loop. So you could actually watch it from start to finish and then watch it backwards, and you'd still get the essence
you
of
couldn't
the animation.
Encompass all of it, because I was looking at it very intently and I was trying to catch it. It starts at the top of the pyramid, if you like, and there are all sorts of intricate designs and repeated tropes.
And you're looking
going
at
on.
Civilization. You're looking at all the every level has different kind of
and you're
people
and you're
of sorts.
And it's moving down, and you're trying to keep up with it and see all the different things, and it's so cool. And then it turns to winter, and then they're eating a fish, and then you're following all your, and I'm sure your eye is being directed at certain things.
Well,
it's
on some ways,
and then
it sort of
goes back up again.
Yeah, it's looking to some degree at the cyclical nature of society collapsing and then rebuilding. And it's just a really fun thing to look at that does something with animation that a lot of people aren't used to seeing. I mean, it's like
I've never seen anything.
It's like installation
like this.
Art. It's a little bit like almost like playing a video game or something in terms of what it does to your mind. So,
well, in a weird way, as a student of visual effects, back in the day, I once had this extraordinary experience where I had been at Premiere and we had done a big story on James Cameron's Titanic, and we were up getting a look at the visual effects sizzle reel that they were going to give for the bake-off. And Rob Legato, the great VFX guy, was explaining those little men on the Titanic, the visual effects people that there was a guy who wielded a broom. There was a guy that was, you know, a mop. Yeah. They repeated their actions, and that's what they did, you know, and that's what the VFX, sequences with all those people would be created from. And that's sort of what this is. There are all these little sections of this thing or that are repeated motions, and they're intricate, but on a much more massive, complicated level.
Another thing that comes out of this is we were talking in more general terms, like why are the docs and the live action so bleak and you know, dealing with these troubling issues with the world, whereas animation doesn't necessarily go that route. To some degree, it's because a lot of animators are thinking more in what you're describing. They're inclined to think in terms of what can I do with motion and graphics and just pure visual experience that hasn't been done before, especially when you have people who are working with shorts where there's a little bit more room for experimentation. So this is definitely the most experimental one, but also in that sense, the most exciting form of animation just in contention for an Oscar this year.
It would be
really cool.
It would be against the grain of what they usually do. For example, for all we know, Burrow's the one that's going to win, because the one that won last year was the hair one. What was it called? By Matt Cherry.
Matt Cherry.
So that was the super cool, very, very.
But also had a topicality to it.
It's an emotion.
That's true. It has to translate into something.
So this one doesn't have emotion, but I think it'll win anyway because it's so cool.
It leaves an impression. But then you have something like Genius Loki, which is this really beautiful, painterly,
gorgeous
French film.
But it lacks narrative drive.
Yeah. It's the thing is, it's like when you watch it, you're like, what did I just watch? Because it's sort of someone's memories of sorts, but it doesn't totally crystallize as a narrative. So that is an interesting question of, you know, which way would it go there? I wasn't super crazy about Yes People, the Icelandic one, which is just a bunch of people living in an apartment, kind of having overlapping lives. It felt a little like a Roy Anderson kind of a thing, but it never totally got to that level. And then if anything,
and then there's
happens,
the one that's
you.
About the shooting. And
so
that
I guess there
beautiful.
Is a timely one.
The hand drawn that if I were to do a sort of cynical, which one is going to win based on how they voted in the past, that would be the one. In fact, it leads most of the polls.
If Anything Happens, I Love You would be the one because it's, again, emotion and
it's beautifully done. I cried.
It does tie into a major
right on
national
cue.
Issue. Yeah. It's effective. So I
and it's
I suppose,
beautiful hand drawn animation, and you don't know where it's going as you go. You realize there's grief sticking parents, but you don't know.
So math
why.
Would say it's that one, but we interestingly agree that there's another one that is more exciting just for on a pure formalism level. Nevertheless, I mean, just talking about these, it's such a different dialogue than the films that we've been talking about.
Oh, well, we're having the excitement of discovery in some ways.
Exactly.
You know, and it's not this well-trodden trench at this point. No, yeah. We can be honest about it. The Oscars were delayed by 2 months. And in a normal year, you're sick of it by this time.
But I mean, it's also like, we're talking about newcomer, like we haven't even mentioned filmmaker names yet. We'd have to like really be as knowledgeable as possible to have them memorized and to know their stories and so forth. And that's what's kind of interesting about it. It's almost closer to a film festival process going through shorts than it is, you know, a traditional kind of dialogue about award season prospects. And for some of these filmmakers, you know, it sets them on a really interesting path. So why don't we do live action next? I think that one has some fascinating stories.
I think they were all pretty good, actually.
I think they're pretty good. There are some I like more than others, for sure.
What's your favorite?
I think probably my favorite, just because I'm a sucker for the long take, is Wide Eye, which
Incredible.
Is this Israeli short.
That is my favorite, too.
What's
because
cool
of the
about
filmmaking.
It, when does that happen?
It's Rivera. It's also the best story. Because the guy is sort of a jerk. This guy who got his bike stolen.
Yeah, it's basically a guy who finds his stolen bike and tries to call the cops to do something about it. I've been, by the way, in a situation where you try to tell the cops about something. One time I lost my wallet and it doesn't quite translate right, and then you're worried that like you're gonna get in trouble for something. There's something very real about that scenario, but then of course what happens to this guy who reports his stolen bike when he tries to get somebody else who he thinks is the thief in trouble for it
assumes is the thief.
Yeah, it brings racial bias into it, immigration, and it all spirals
in an unexpected direction. And it's remarkably well done. I like that a lot.
But as we say, I mean,
he becomes the entitled guy. He becomes the guy who can afford to pay for the bike. He's not the guy being thrown in jail and deported. But
the other thing about it is the long take. We've seen so many movies over the years that use the long take almost as like an excuse just to like gloss over things. I think it has a real practical effect here because it shows you just how much a sort of almost mundane situation can quickly spiral out of control and go in all these different directions.
I think real time is a real ally for this one.
So, I mean, the question is, does that one have the edge? Because it's a bit heady in terms of just being, you know, investing in what it's doing.
The other one, which is called The Present, in another way, is a similar story. In the sense that you get the slow burn of this poor Palestinian guy, sort of
also
handsome
and together,
you know, with a daughter going through the routine of going across the border and all the humiliations that he has to suffer all these different ways, how it explodes in his face as well. And I would say that they're both very good, but but Wide Eye is more interesting and more innovative in the way that it starts to tell you some of the same stories.
The President has some great stuff. I thought it was a little too long for what it's doing, but it ends very well. It has a bicycle.
It's a great ending.
Quality to it.
I mean,
it is neorealism essentially. It's using the real backdrop of, you know, a Palestinian and his daughter who have to cross this border and deal with Israeli BS every time, where you're putting your life on the line, and he has to hold his temper.
He has to hold his temper.
Yeah, no, exactly.
and he eventually does not.
Yeah, and something happens, and it is unsettling, but also quite emotional and bittersweet. So I don't know. It's interesting. I wonder which of those would resonate with the voters who are actually committing to watching all of the shorts. Because
remember that's a small a group of people. So let's talk about this. As you know, I've been talking to some Oscar voters and the ballots. We're talking on Thursday, so the ballots opened up today. They have 5 days to vote, and they've all been playing catch up. But many of them are not going to be voting in a lot of the categories, and a lot of people I spoke to are not voting for the shorts. They didn't have time. They're not voting for foreign. They didn't have time. They didn't even look at all the docs. So it's the animations and short branch, which is a few hundred people, that are the core of who's going to vote for the shorts. It's not the entire Academy. So just
which
so
is,
you
which is annoying,
keep that in mind.
As usual, that something about this system isn't quite working. Like,
well, this year especially. And yeah, you'd think they'd had two extra months to watch everything, but it isn't true. They've only had the period of time since the nominations for the shorts,
everyone has
really
their lives. I mean, people in all these different branches, they're not like us where it's like our job is to watch everything.
I've been saying this all along. We're ahead of them in terms of what we've seen.
It's tied into what you do when you go to festivals and you see films at press
absolutely
previews, you know, and that all that kind of stuff. But it does raise these interesting questions for next year of, you know, exactly how do you message to people or make it tangible for people to watch all this stuff? Because if they just get exhausted and throw up their hands and they're not going to get booted as a member as a result, then nobody wins. I mean, it's just, we just wind up with a very small
this
pool
is a,
of voters.
Is, so. This is an anomalous year where a lot of people just checked out. You know, they just didn't want to watch on their computer. They didn't get their computer hooked up to the TV, you know, all sorts of reasons why they are not paying attention the way they ordinarily would, or they just don't care. It's a, I hope it gets, goes back to something more like normal next year.
Well, baby steps, and let's get through the global pandemic, and then we can start to assess the future of Oscar season.
But did you of the other live action shorts?
Let's talk about The Letter Room, which has an actual star in it, Oscar Isaac. Who's
directed
by his
wife. Good. He's I liked The Letter Room actually.
I liked it to a.
It did
I
come
the idea
out the way
was
I
like
thought
that.
It would. It's a prison. It's a prison guy, guard who fights to get a desk job, and he ends up reading all the letters that come into the prison, and he gets caught up in one particular interchange or lack thereof between a death row prisoner and his ex girlfriend.
Yeah, I mean, Oscar Isaac is one of our great actors, and I think he sells that character pretty well. It didn't grab me past the kind of initial setup, and I didn't find the resolution all that.
No, it was a good resolution
overall. I just there was something
bit
about
of a twist.
It sort of dissipated for me with time, but I understand that in some ways you could argue that's the most quote unquote commercial one in that category. It's very accessible. But I
would
enjoyed,
say Two Distant Strangers is also accessible.
I enjoyed Two Distant Strangers. It's a little clunky and short filmy, like in an amateurish way in parts. I thought there were certain beats that felt a little off.
It's a great concept though.
But yeah, the concept of basically we know that Groundhog Day is basically a genre now, but the idea of a black man who gets killed by the same cop again and again and again is like really profound and powerful, but also a really great vessel for dark comedy in the way that it's handled.
It's really well done. And he basically figures out all sorts of ways to try to get out of it. And he keeps going back anyway. And there's even a part where he makes friends with the white cop and it still backfires. It's very well done.
I mean, that's one where I definitely, and I really like the way it starts. Like it doesn't just kind of jump right into it. It's willing to kind of allow the logic to gradually settle in, so you're sort of in this world and seeing how this happens before the absurdity of it comes in. So I thought, I was watching it, I was like, these are filmmakers, Trayvon Free and Martin Desmond Rowe. I wrote those names down because I could see something with those guys.
Rowe is more of the professional director who's done directing before, and Trayvon's more of the writer who's done a lot of writing and hasn't directed that much before.
Good pairing.
But they came together very well.
So why don't we talk about those docs though? Because like you say, that's where the real heaviness kicks in. They're all quite long. I mean, they're all in the 30, just from a short perspective, they're very substantial material.
Look, you just have to gird your loins because you're going to watch starving children in Hunger Ward, and you're gonna go with the kid, you know, the little girl that got killed. Song for Latasha by the Korean woman.
At the end of the day, I do think we should take a step back from that kind of like reading of this overall, because none of these shorts was made to be seen in the context of a category of films that all deal with these really harsh subjects. So, you know,
yes, they were. Eric, that's the point.
No,
they were weren't. Made to be.
Well, maybe what you're saying is they were made to be
Oscar shorts,
but I don't.
They are a genre.
But let's take a step back. I don't think the impulse to make, let's say, Do Not Stop was that, which is about Hong Kong protesters, was
that
to
one
make an Oscar
is
nominee,
totally
right?
agitprop. That one is totally of the moment and extremely.
There's a real function in our
fierce.
Society.
Yes.
We need to
yes,
be talking about what's going on
of
over
course.
There.
Of course, we have to be talking about world hunger, and we have to be talking about violence in the inner city. Of course, we have to be talking about all of those things, but it becomes Oscar porn on some level.
But then Song for Latasha, that's one where obviously it's timely in a very immediate way because it's about a young woman who was unjustly murdered, and yet the way in which it deals with that cinematically is fascinating. It doesn't use old footage, doesn't use archival or talking heads.
There's some archival from the 80s.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's almost like time in that sense. I mean, it's like using.
It is like time. It's using some recreations too.
Yeah, like the aesthetics of it are.
But
really
there's one section where the friend as an adult is talking about what happened and how she lost her friend.
That's tough.
And who her friend was. That is brilliant. It's extraordinary. And that was my favorite part of it. And I almost preferred the direct, unsullied, unedited part of the movie over some of the more attempted to be filmic sections, if that makes sense.
Well, I dug the filmic stuff. I mean, it was certainly trying things. But again, I mean, that's sort of When we throw around terms like Oscar porn, I wonder if it's like, was this an obvious one in that sense? Because it's taking such a unusual approach to its material, and it's more challenging. It's asking the audience to invest in that approach. And I thought that was fascinating because much like this Groundhog Day short in a weird sort of way, it's giving you something more. It's not just taking for granted that this subject matter is important and terrible and we all need to take it seriously. It's building something creative out of that necessity. And that's what I really appreciated about
that's
it.
Fair.
And
that's
I,
fair.
And I think that
and
would
I was
probably
very
be
moved.
A front runner, right?
I think Latasha's very strong. I was moved by it as well, because what it really is building is an argument for what the life that was lost could have been, which is the whole point,
right,
of these lost people who could have had lives and were unnecessarily removed from the equation.
I should mention, I think earlier I said Do Not Stop. The title is Do Not Split, which makes more sense in the context of the issue that we're talking about here.
Hong Kong versus China.
Yeah. Which is a very messy situation, but it's one that has also, as a result of the subject of this film, caused backlash from China, which is not airing the Oscars. Obviously, there's also some Nomadland, Chloe Zhao stuff going on there. But that, of all things, to create that kind of problem, a short film, it's very interesting that it would have that kind of resonance. And obviously, that means that they're on to something. So that it seems like that's a potential
upset. The filmmaking is extraordinary in that sense. You could compare it. There have been other political movies in the past that have gone, you know, have won because of what was going on in the world at the time. The one that comes to mind is the Asghar Farhadi movie that won A Separation.
Right, the first
and,
one.
I want to check that too, because I think there was a second Asghar Farhadi that was it's the one where he wasn't allowed to come, and so he ended up winning.
Yeah, well, Salesman. What happened with The Salesman was I think he could have gotten permission, but because of the Trump Muslim ban. Was sort of a protest move not to go, if I recall correctly. And so I think that that was a
whatever, however that where... played out. Let's just say with Asghar Farhadi and the salesman, there was a big ruckus about whether or not he was going to be able to participate with the Oscars, and that ended up playing out in his favor. He got a lot of support.
And, he won.
So sometimes it becomes part of the story. You're right. Do Not Split could benefit from high, strong feelings about what's going on with Hong Kong and China. Just watching the movie is extremely upsetting because you do see how fierce
the chaos
and,
on the streets
and how angry and upset and fraught the whole situation.
Well, you have people saying right now I can cuss China, but if I don't protest, I might not be able to do that. And that's the kind of thing that I think is not, that message isn't traveling well enough in the West. And that's really why I think it's really effective at what it's getting across. Now is it easy to sit through? No. I mean, that's sort of the essential gamble of a lot of this stuff. It's why people are saying Octopus Teacher and not Collective or whatever. I mean, it's a challenge for people to watch difficult stuff, but it's also your responsibility on some level. So I hope that people do give these kinds of movies the time of day, even if it's not so easy to do that, especially in these times. But
it's also an interesting year for the disabled community because one of the films that's going up against My Octopus Teacher is Crip Camp. And of course, that's the story of a disabled community having a wonderful summer camp experience in the 60s and 70s, and then going on to become, powerful activists in the disabled movement and putting through, groundbreaking legislation for their rights. And I would say that the other movie, and of course Jim LeBrecht is disabled himself, so he could win. He could become
a co-director
who wins. Yeah. And then the other movie that on the short side which was lovely actually, I should have my list in front of me. What's the name of the one with where the blind deaf guy is talking to Feel My Touch? Is that the name of it?
Yes.
Feel My Touch is the one where it's a lovely movie, a little too on the nose, but again, another opportunity for the disabled community to have
sentimental
representation at the Oscars.
I tend to throw that word in as a pejorative, but I did think it was well directed for what it was doing. That just in terms of what it does with two people learning to communicate who can't communicate in a traditional kind of way, I thought was pretty effective over the course of the story that it's telling.
And I was moved. I was moved by the ending.
Yeah.
All right. So another
blind deaf guy who figures out a way to communicate with somebody else was very interesting.
Yeah. But the homeless guy who communicates with he helps out the blind and deaf guy, and the blind and deaf guy in the end helps him. And that was lovely. Yep. But I was moved by it. That's the thing. They get you. They do get you. But the other one I was moved by, although again, Colette, which is one of the doc entries, French short film about a Holocaust survivor who goes back to a cemetery, to a concentration camp, to see where her brother was killed. It was heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. But at the same time, that the filmmaker is taking this woman there to get an emotional reaction out of her.
Yeah, I think that there is something there for sure. I mean,
she was a wonderful woman. She was really admirable, and she did break down and deal with it. And she was willing to do that, and she put herself through it. We should be reminded over and over and over of what horrors occurred, but it feels like what they do at the Oscars.
Yeah, I mean, it became a cliche a long time ago to have that requisite Holocaust movie slot, but it's been a while since that requisite Holocaust
I know.
Movie slot.
So who
delivered.
Are we to complain?
So, we kind of got past that. So those stories still kind of matter, and a lot of those people are dying off. So it's not a bad thing for it to be in the mix in that respect. But in the short time we have left, maybe we should touch on the sort of tragic news of LA's exhibition update, which is losing the Pacific Cinemas and the ArcLight. Now, I don't have a profound relationship to these theaters because I just went to them when I was in town. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what significance they've had to you? Because obviously there's that side of it, and then there's the business.
Well, the Cinerama Dome is on this very specific spot at Sunset and Vine, basically, and it's the only geodesic theater dome left in the country that's working, or it was, and it has landmark status, so it's not like they can just demolish it overnight. They can if all other avenues are exhausted, but if someone comes in, there's going to be a year where you could figure out what to do with it and say, and they did that with the ArcLight. There was going to be some horrible mall thing or something around the Cinerama Dome, and they created what is the ArcLight now. Now, the Pacific Theater chain, 18 theaters around the country, I think 10 of them in LA, and a couple of people on our staff have been reporting this, and the company that owns the theaters isn't willing to be in business with. The numbers are too prohibitive. Now, you can think that maybe there's some negotiations going on behind the scenes, that maybe this is the situation that a lot of the exhibitors are dealing with writ large all over the country in terms of rents and overdue payments and all sorts of real estate issues in these analog situations. But we have a beloved theater that everyone goes to, high end, one of the first theaters that had, reserved seats and ushers speaking to you before the movie, and a lot of people associated with opening weekend Q&As. And I hung out with Judi Dench in the green room, and Helen Mirren, and all sorts of people I interviewed there. It's a very, very sad and disturbing loss for Los Angeles, and cinephiles are just horrified, and it's a symbol of the most, one of the most successful theaters in the city going down.
So Edgar Wright went out among the many sort of higher profile people who immediately went to social media about this and said, my first thought is, what can we do? And I think it's an interesting question right now, because there's so much that's uncertain about how the rest of the year is going to go in terms of movie going. But, you know, it does seem like the kind of thing where a Netflix type of entity could.
They already picked up the Paris in New York and the Egyptian in LA.
Well, that's right. So they have one in LA, one in New York.
They're not in the theater business. They're not interested. I mean, the Egyptian is like, they're restoring an historic landmark, and they have a place to do all their award stuff. And they can open their movies there and play them for a week or two. It's not like they have to make a profit on it. They're not interested in being in the theater business.
And I think what they've done with the Paris is fascinating. I mean, they had Ramin Barani doing a Q&A there last year, but they also showed Goodfellas, which inspired White Tiger. So it's kind of a fascinating sort of synergy going on there, where they're showing kind of repertory programming to support Netflix titles in a really interesting kind of way. So
look, this is part of their marketing budget, Eric.
It's marketing.
It's really not like it's their business. They make enough money on their own business.
So spend it however
you want. I'd like to see a studio put their money where their mouth is and help, this is a small theater chain. That's part of the problem. I mean, in a weird way, the bigger theater chains have more access to capital and debt relief and all that sort of thing. This is a big loss for LA, and the Grove is part
studio,
of it.
I mean, it's like, what are we talking about? Like, Universal's not going to just jump into the fray and buy a movie theater, right?
If you think about it, I mean, Disney owns El Capitan. I mean, that's their flagship theater.
Okay, so that's a direction
on Hollywood Boulevard. But I don't. They're not going to get into this because they're putting their money into streaming. Yes. So if you have Universal or you have Warner Brothers, they're putting their money into streaming. They're not interested in. They're already withdrawing from the theater business on some level. It's Sony that would have to do it. Paramount even has Paramount Plus. So
all right. So through a process of elimination,
let's make it Sony.
All right, we'll tell Sony. Let's make sure that but you hear that.
Tommy Rothman, come on.
Pick up the phone. Real estate opportunity. Well, we'll see what happens.
My
on
hope
that
is
front.
That because the theaters and the studios are the ones that should be aligned and should be in partnership and should be supporting each other, and they're not, and it makes me upset.
So on that note, as we wrap, I thought it might be a good opportunity to touch on a studio movie that is apparently going to have a platform in a couple of weeks at a major film festival, because it's a nice excuse to talk about something that looks ahead and is promising, which is In
Tribeca
the Heights.
So Tribeca is happening, and In the Heights is opening Tribeca.
Yeah,
and so we're hoping that we're going to hear about French Dispatch opening Cannes.
Well, we'll see. That would be nice. I mean, we're all holding our breath about Cannes in so many ways. But yeah, In the Heights, I mean, Tribeca has had big studio movies before. I mean, people forget they closed with Avengers one year, which was really fun. I remember seeing that. I think it was at the Ziegfeld. But they've never had
a big theater that never got opened.
It never quite got. Yeah, it never,
it got
never
closed
survived.
And it never, no one saved it.
No.
That's the thing. This business is in danger. It may not, the big theaters may not survive.
It has often been a fragile business. But with respect to In the Heights, there's a movie that, I mean, yes, because it's Warner Brothers, it's going to have a limited kind of theatrical life relative to how people watch it on HBO Max. But it seems to be a big crowd pleaser with really high expectations. Buzz has been great for basically over a year. And Tribeca has potential to be a real in-person kind of festival, at least in theory. So there's hope on the horizon with news like this. And it's you know, fingers crossed. But I think we might be seeing a very different kind of summer than we saw last year. So we'll see where we are after the Oscars, and hopefully when we get there, we'll have all kinds of different movies to talk about that are on the calendar. But in the meantime,
looking forward.
Next week,
I can't wait to see you In the Heights. I'm excited. The trailer's
fantastic.
Next week,
we got to go back and talk about the Oscars just a little bit longer, because it's our last chance to put those predictions out there.
Goodbye, Eric. I'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you later.